Welcome to Managing Uncertainty, a podcast series from the experts at BrightPath discussing global risk, business continuity, and crisis management. Will you be ready to lead your organization through its critical moment?
Hello, and welcome to the Managing Uncertainty podcast, BrightCast edition. For the week of August 19th, 2019, this is Brian Strauser, Principal and CEO here at BrightPath.
This is Barry Wheeler, Consultant at BrightPath. So we start out this week talking about Brexit, a light subject to
Very
start
light.
With.
There's no details for Brexit at
no,
all.
No, no. So the thing I think we wanted to touch on with Brexit here this week is really kind of the state of the state of where it's at and where we likely think it's going to go. It's looking like no deal Brexit is really the course of action, the pathway that they're pursuing. And I think the implications for companies right now is really being prepared for that. There's a lot of, you know, economic and other kind of issues associated with that, but there's some practical challenges with that too, some of which include hard borders, the ability to travel and requiring different paperwork to be able to do that. Citizens of the EU who live in London, if you have employees that are...
Or anywhere in the UK, but yeah, primarily London, I would think.
That if they're EU citizens, there's been some conversation around some hard immigration enforcement when no deal Brexit occurs. And nobody really knows what that looks like.
It's interesting that we're talking about this now. Here we are in August 2019, because when we created our first global risk report for 2018, which we wrote in December 2017, we listed Brexit as one of the top 12 global risks of 2018. And here's what we said. The United Kingdom is still negotiating the terms and timetable for its departure from the European Union, a supremely political event that has already led to the downfall of one prime minister and may yet cost Theresa May her government as well. The ongoing uncertainty of the future relationship between the United Kingdom and the European Union is what defines this as a top global risk for the coming year. Theresa May is not the prime minister anymore. It's Boris Johnson.
She is not. It did cost her her job.
It did. Her entire premiership was dominated by Brexit and really nothing else.
Really nothing else.
Really nothing else. So we are on the precipice of, what, about 8 weeks from now, a potential no-deal Brexit starting at the end of October, 1st of November. And to your point, it could mean that there's a hard border. The hard border question is really about the separation of Northern Ireland from the Republic of Ireland.
Right.
Because there is no border there right now, because Northern Ireland is part of the UK and the Republic of Ireland is part of the EU. They're all in the EU. So there's not a hard border there today. And there would probably have to be one under a no-deal Brexit agreement.
There would be. And I think that kind of leads into kind of part two of this sort of conversation around Brexit. You know, really why that border matters for Northern Ireland and Ireland is that was the representation of the, you know, violence that was occurring there for decades between those two sides of
Between partisans Ireland. Involved in the
right.
fight anyway, the IRA and others.
That there is a real worry that the hardening of that border will reinstitute some of those feelings and that violence, which that kind of openness of that border has really, people say, has gone a long way to kind of diminish the violence and kind of the hard feelings for the majority of people. Certainly there's still kind of diehards on both sides, but there's real concern. And we're starting to see a little bit of that kind of start to pop up in conversations. Now, how much it's directly tied to Brexit isn't real clear, but we have seen kind of reports of violence. So most recently in the last 24 hours, there was an explosion in Northern Ireland where there was kind of a deliberate, what they think is a deliberate targeting of law enforcement by setting off one explosion to draw them in and then setting off a secondary device with the intent to hurt, kill law enforcement. Now, fortunately, it didn't.
There were no injuries,
as
I understand.
Injuries, but it comes on the heels of a bombing in July and then a kind of a booby-trapped explosive on a police officer's car in Northern London in June. So we've seen a few months in a row of some explosive kind of incidents within Northern Ireland.
Well, there's a number. I mean, there's a number of other, to your point, there's been a number of other similar kind of situations. This one in particular kind of stood out to us, and we learned of this, I think, first through some news sent around by U.S. law enforcement about a potential threat to law enforcement. But we agreed that this is probably more tied to the Brexit fight or some other issue in Northern Ireland. The interesting part of this is that there was some type of hoax device that attracted the attention of law enforcement. Law enforcement, as we understand it right now, established a secure perimeter and began working on this hoax device when a secondary device inside that secure perimeter was detonated. And obviously it was real. It did detonate. And we don't know much more than that. But it reminded us of situations that exercises we've been involved with previously with U.S. law enforcement, where part of the exercise was to get law enforcement or fire EMS personnel to gather in a specific location for staging or investigative purposes, and then having a simulated explosive device, since this is an exercise, we're not trying to really kill people,
right?
Then detonate and remove individuals from play for the remainder of the day because they're dealing with injury to them. So this is a very common terrorist tactic, is to have a primary device, get attention of public safety personnel, and then detonate a secondary device that impacts first responders. And this felt and read like a textbook case of that.
Yes. Yeah, and I think it's not a great sign overall, but it also contributes, I think, to the broader narrative that's going on, you know, just in general around escalating violence and getting into copycat and all that kind of, you know, inspiration type stuff too, which I think is kind of our next kind of topic as well.
Yeah, our second topic of the day is about targeted violence in the United States. So there's a couple incidents here I think we want to mention that have all been in the news, but I think we're going to draw a connection here that's important. The first is we've had a number of mass shooting incidents in 2019 and even going back a couple of years that you could describe clearly as having an ideological motive, and that motive is targeted violence towards a specific group of people. In a couple cases in the United States, it's been targeted based on religion, and that has been aimed at the Jewish community. We saw the Synagogue of Life shootings in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. Those have been echoed by similar attempts or actual shooting incidents at a number of, again, targeted at the Jewish community, persons of the Jewish faith. Second, we see this targeting of immigrants, particularly Hispanic immigrants, appears to be the ideological motive in the El Paso, Texas Walmart mass shooting, and to some extent at the Garlic Festival in California. And so we've seen a number of instances, and these are just two of the recent ones. I think if you go farther back, there's been a number of instances of targeted violence with an ideological motive. I think there's still some question about Dayton and what the motivation was for the shooting in the bar district in Dayton, Ohio. But we have these clear examples where we have violence aimed at the Jewish community. We've got violence aimed at
Muslim community.
At the Muslim community. We've got these shootings now in New Zealand, and then the shooting that happened in Norway, where I think that was an attempted shooting, where that one was thwarted by a retired Pakistani Air Force officer that tackled the guy. But the point here is that there's some clear instances of targeted violence, in some cases coming from what the media would describe as white supremacists, or what law enforcement has described as white supremacists, aimed at different minority communities here in the United States or in locations like New Zealand and Norway. The other warning that I think we've seen is, and we've seen this on a smaller scale, it hasn't evolved to this mass shooting level of incident yet, but we're seeing there's the threat of, we think there'll be more of these types of attacks, particularly as the rhetoric around the issue of immigration in the United States and the 2020 presidential and congressional elections, I only see the rhetoric getting worse.
Yeah.
And with that, I think we would expect to see additional violent acts along these lines aimed at targeted groups. We also think that the opposite is going to happen, and that is particularly around individuals who believe that or know that someone or a group of individuals are white supremacists, or they think that they're white supremacists because of some action or comments that they've made, or because of their political affiliation, will engage in violence against those individuals. And so we only see this as becoming more disruptive and uncertain going into the 2020 election season. I think it gets worse than what we have seen over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think just the environment and the national narrative right now kind of lends itself to this escalation of, you know, not just rhetoric anymore, but into action, and then eventually into counteraction against, you know, those groups or that perception that the white supremacists, white nationalists, whatever you want to call them, that narrative, the more frontal that gets, likely the louder the counter voice is going to be. And because we've moved beyond simply just discourse, even uncivil discourse around it, into action, it's very likely that, you know, the environment is just one of action by these groups, and we'll likely see more and more. And Joe Q Public, you know, is going to be caught kind of in that swirl.
So the challenge here for organizations and even for individuals to some extent here is, how do you take this possibility of increased risk of more of these types of incidents, and how do you factor that into your planning, knowing that, I mean, we can take the El Paso, Texas incident as a good example of this. We know a lot of folks at Walmart. They run an excellent global security program, but this is not an attack that you could have foreseen happening in that environment, right? The target was not Walmart.
Right.
It's just the location that the shooter went to get to the targeted audience that he wanted to commit violence against. So for the organization, like, what advice can we give to the folks listening on the podcast? What can you start to factor in to your own planning and preparedness based on what we've witnessed here lately?
Well, I think first off, you have to just assume that something like this could happen. It's the reality. Now, whether or not it's intentional or not, the risk is there. You know, it could just as easily be an accident. Someone has goes into diabetic shock, and the car they're driving goes through the front vestibule and keeps going. You know, it's the same type of response that you'll likely have to provide, you know, in the moment, regardless of what the nature of the, you know, the motivation or the context of the situation is. You know, it's being prepared for that possibility, and assume that it could happen to you, and have that hat on as you're thinking through these things. Mm-hmm. I think that's just baseline. Assume that it could happen to you, and what do you have in place to prevent or mitigate or help respond to those situations?
I think it changes the narrative a little bit on the, you know, when you're thinking about what are those top risks that you need to plan for, and what are the worst case scenario events going to be? I think in my career, I thought about individualized acts of violence that were aimed at an individual, or like, I knew in my previous life, corporate life, that a homicide that happened at a location that I was responsible for was probably pure criminal activity, not of a targeted violence type, but like I've got a gang issue that bled into the workplace, and we just happened to be the place where that happened. Or it was a domestic violence situation, which was what we typically saw, right? That came into the workplace as the location where that act was going to be committed.
Right.
I don't know that I really thought about, it's much more likely that I was going to deal with this kind of situation than one of those two previous ones, like a mass shooting versus the other. So I think it's kind of like the pre-9/11 state of thought, that it's time to start thinking that these kind of things could be a reality in your place of business.
Well, I think even as we get closer to election season, and you know, candidates become solidified, and you know, lawn signs are out and commercials are out, and you know, the narrative really starts to pick up, it gets a lot more personal, and it feels a lot more personal to people. And I think that's where businesses, whether or not you're, you know, a retailer that's open to the public, or a restaurant or something like that, or just a closed off kind of office building, you really need to start thinking about what could happen at your location, but also what's happening in your neighborhood and being prepared for protest activity, violent marches, general just acts of violence, criminal activity, things like that. It just, everything seems to kind of heat up, you know, and it doesn't have to be a convention location or a speech or something like that. It could just be the Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday evening commute that groups are taking issue with. So I think it's just having that mindset of being prepared and feeling in a state of where you feel like you can be nimble, mm-hmm. but also prepared to what mm-hmm. to what's happening.
We're going to do an upcoming episode specifically on kind of recent targeted violence, more to get into the details of what's happened and what do we see from that, and
yeah.
what are some specific things companies should do. But we thought this was a good topic to include for today, given that we saw this targeted attack in Northern Ireland, and we've seen these other recent attacks, and we think there's going to be more to come. So this definitely kind of filters in as a big risk for organizations.
Well, I think the one piece that kind of tied those two back together as well is we're seeing a lot in the U.S. and it feels very U.S. centric. It's also happening in Europe and other places too. You know, Australia, there's been these things in recent years. So, you know, really in kind of Western democracies, this kind of narrative and this political instability, if you want to call it that, of just these kind of countering ideas, you know, the nationalism, the white supremacy, whatever it is, it's true kind of across those countries. So companies that are operating in those places, you know, if you're global in that sense, don't just assume it for the US, think about it for Europe as well. Mm-hmm. Think about it for Australia, et cetera. So next topic we have really is kind of more recent too, obviously, but we have reports, or there's been some kind of news coverage around 23 Texas towns have been struck by a coordinated ransomware attack, according to the state's Department of Information Resources. So this kind of comes on the heel. This started, sounds like Friday morning, kind of through the weekend in Texas, where 23 towns were kind of hit with these attacks. Now, authorities have been able to determine that one threat actor, or they've stated they believe there's been one threat actor responsible for all 23. They don't yet know who's responsible. But really, this kind of comes on the heels of some other recent attacks in Maryland, New York, Louisiana, Florida. They're more locally for us. There was a town in Minnesota that was hit with that as well, and I believe paid the ransom for it. But really, we're starting to see kind of these kind of more bigger ransomware attacks directed at kind of state local governments. We don't know how successful in terms of actually getting ransoms paid to that. There have been reports that ransoms have been paid, but I think just more broadly, the financial impact of those two, just to shut them down, respond to them, investigate them, mm-hmm. is obviously there. Aside from just paying the ransom, there's kind of a monetary impact there. And the fact that they're kind of going there obviously could impact business activity, given that kind of these governments are shut down right now, kind of offline, so to speak, but also lends itself to just the general kind of environment of ransomware and the success that, mm-hmm. you know, one actor is having.
This conversation's come up here in Minnesota a couple times, because I think there's about 375 individual municipalities in Minnesota. Of course, there's like six cities over 100,000, Minneapolis and St. Paul by far being the largest. But almost all of this IT work in the state, although there are some shared services through some associations, every city kind of does their own thing, right? And some of these cities are smaller towns that have like a city manager and three or four staff members. And somebody there is in charge of information security, who probably is like, you know, the water bill collector or right. what have you. And I'm not casting aspersions on anybody, but I know like here in Minnesota, because we just saw media around this a few weeks ago, they've had some ransomware attacks, and at least one city coughed up $175,000 to get their computers unencrypted, which surprisingly they bait it and it did get unencrypted.
Yeah. Well, and I think we've heard narratives through news and white papers and discussions with just various people that there really is kind of there's almost a cost of doing business attitude towards some of these things lately. or at least that's kind of where people are starting to kind of trend mindset that if, you know, hey, if I can just, I'm a multi-billion-dollar company, if I can pay $100,000 to make this go away, well, that's a lot cheaper than trying to investigate and, you know, notify and do all these other things. Pay the $100,000, get the data back, get the access right. back, whatever, move on.
Right.
That it's a, that it is a cost of doing business, but that's probably not sustainable, nor is it the, probably the right thing to do at the end of the day. But, you know, it's that, that's the question that companies have to face. And it's a real, it is a real question now for companies on the ransom. Do you pay it? Do you not pay it? How does it, do you have a, even a, you know, a lot of times they come through as Bitcoin. Do you even have a Bitcoin account system set up to be able to transact that?
Right.
A lot of companies don't.
I'm going to be very unhip for a minute. I didn't have a Bitcoin account of any type, but there's a website that I wanted to support that was kind of independent media. And the only way that this guy took donations was via Bitcoin. And so I had to figure out, like, how do I send him the $50 donation that I want to give him for the year, even though I have a Bitcoin account? And it was a frustrating experience to figure out, like, how to do that without diving into the whole Bitcoin experience.
Well, and it's quite the process, as I understand it, to be able to even do that should the ransomware come up and should that come through. I mean, just logistically, that's a challenge. Aside from just the question of to pay it, not to pay it, you know, being prepared to do so becomes challenging.
And in my mind, these kind of low-hanging attacks are only going to become more common. To me, like, cities and townships is the front line of government. I'm sure, I probably shouldn't assume this, but I would think a large city like Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington, Duluth, if I'm picking cities here in Minnesota, probably have relatively robust information security capability. But, like, I live in a town of 25,000 people. Is that town secure? I don't know. I hope my mayor's not listening. But, like, is it secure?
Right.
And could somebody get in there and ransomware, you know, the city? And our office is in an even smaller town next to where I live, and it could be the same situation. So I think this risk continues to be in place, and it's definitely something companies and public sector agencies should continue to look at.
Kind of back to the other point, is the $100,000 ransom worth the investment rather than spending multi-million dollars trying to beef up security for a town of 2,500 people? Mm-hmm. You know, where's the cost benefit for some of these cities? But yeah, I think this risk, especially because of just the inherent vulnerabilities likely in a lot of these places, just given size and resource constraints and things like that, that, you know, this will be a thing. And, you know, certainly we can see it with smaller businesses, mid-sized businesses. You know, it's the same challenges they have as the resource constraint and the ability to constantly monitor, challenge back, mitigate, things like that. Mm-hmm. That, you know, more resource-heavy corporations still face. You know, they just have a kind of a greater pool of capability to defend it off or rectify it.
So our last topic for this podcast is one that we've talked about several times, so we're not going to get in a lot of detail here, but the unrest in Hong Kong continues. This weekend on Sunday, there was it was estimated 1.7 million people came out and protested peacefully. There was no airport disruption. I don't think there's any other kind of broad disruption. It was a very peaceful protest.
Yeah, I think purposely so.
Very purposely so. They've learned some lessons from some nonviolent movements of the past.
Lots of umbrellas.
This protest, again, was quite peaceful. And I think there's no sign here that this is going to let up, that this is going to continue. Mm-hmm. Their demands are the same. They want Carrie Lam to resign. They want China to keep their mainland policies on the mainland and not to interfere in the home government authority of Hong Kong. So the dispute goes on. I think it's important to note that the Hong Kong population is right at about 8 million people, and 1.7 million of them came out to protest. I mean, the numbers are just incredible.
Yeah. If you see pictures and video that's come out over the weekend, you know, there's Ian Bremmer from Eurasia Group. He's quite the Twitter person, posted a video of, he called it parting of the protester sea or something like that, where a fire engine was coming down the streets, you know, but otherwise it's full of people just covered in umbrellas, and all of a sudden they just, you see the gap. And then moving aside for the, the fire engine and just closing it back up.
The first weekend of protest, it was an ambulance that you saw on the video doing the same thing that the crowd parted so the ambulance could get through.
Yep.
And then took the street back over.
Yeah, I mean, just the images of these protests. And I think the certainly it was raining over the weekend in Hong Kong, so that's part of the reason for the umbrellas. The other part is likely due to the facial recognition challenges that protesters are trying to counteract. That, you know, if it's just a bunch of umbrellas, you can't really... You can't tell. They're pretty stunning in terms of just the scale and scope of some of the, I mean, stretches of city blocks, stretches of roadways, you know, full of people. So it's 1.7 million people participating is a, that is a sizable group of people. It's not your couple hundred protesters. This is a fifth of the population, a quarter of the population of Hong Kong participating in this.
We expect these kind of protests are going to continue in Hong Kong. I would assess that the protesters are definitely going to continue their move towards or kind of back to where they started in terms of nonviolent protests. I mean, we may see them occupy other facilities. I know there's a court order prohibiting them from blocking the airport, but who knows where some of that goes over time. But we certainly expect this is going to be an ongoing challenge for some time to come between Hong Kong and China.
Well, and they've been fairly creative, you know, throughout this and in finding ways to kind of create disruption and do different things. So as one door closes, they tend to have a couple more ready to open up or already open.
So that's it for this week's edition, the Brightcast edition of the Managing Uncertainty podcast. We'll be back on Monday with a new topical podcast. Until then, be well.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Managing Uncertainty, produced by the experts at BrightPath. To receive notifications of new episodes, join our newsletter at brightpath.com or subscribe to your favorite podcast player, such as iTunes or Google Play. Learn more about the services and trusted advice from BrightPath by visiting brightpath.com. That's BrightPath.com.